Welcome. You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
The groundwork for this crisis was built with the escalating inequality in wealth and income that was, you know, an inevitable outgrowth of the neoliberal economic policies that came ascendant beginning in the 1980s.
That's the voice of author and economist Robin Hennell. On this week's show, we speak to Robin Hennell about the U.S. government's shutdown and charting a way forward in these troubled times.
Now, we are live with Dr. Robin Hennell. Robin Hennell is a professor of economics at American University. His most recent book is Economic Justice and Democracy. He's actually the author of Political Economy of Participatory Economics. He has been very active in many social movements and organizations over the past 40 years, most recently with the Southern Maryland Greens and the Green Party in the USA. Very privileged to have you in our program. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's great to be with you, and I just wanted to give a shout-out to a courageous fighter for South American independence from American imperialism, Martha Harnacker, who is now living in Vancouver, where you are, and she's recovering from a medical condition. I can think of nobody over the past 40 years that has been a more courageous fighter for independence for South America and for a new kind of world. So I just wanted to give her a shout out on your show this morning.
Thank you, and thank you for reminding us of that struggle, because ultimately, when we look at the world and the challenges we face today, whether it's climate change, economic downturns, you know, it is about a different vision of a world without an imperialistic design. So perhaps we could begin there by talking a little bit about the context under which this American government shutdown has taken place. It is now 11 days since the government shut down, and there seems to be an impasse. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what is driving this kind of political chess game, because it seems in the past, every time something like this happens, austerity is the answer to all our problems. So can you put a little context as to what are we facing here, and who are the key players?
Well, the key players are the Republican Party here in the United States. They have been practicing what we really should just call scorched earth policy since the day that Obama was elected. They have not played the role of a loyal opposition. This last incident is sort of perhaps the most notable. It's the one where more people are simply noticing, no, you're not playing by the democratic rules. You are, in fact, you know, refusing to abide by laws that have been passed through the normal political procedure. You're basically holding the country's well-being hostage to your campaign. So that's what's going on. I mean, one ironic twist is that this particular crisis is creating a crisis within the Republican Party, between one faction, the Tea Party faction, that wants to hold the country ransom and demand that Obamacare, the health care plan, be overturned, before they'll let the country go back about its normal business. The other faction within the Republican Party is more realistic in the sense that they know that will never happen, that can't happen. They want to use the same kind of threat and the same kind of blackmail to attack the quote-unquote entitlement programs here in the United States. They want to have Obama sit down and rediscuss whether or not there can be some sort of grand fiscal compromise. Now, grand fiscal compromise for them is essentially defunding Social Security, defunding Medicare, and providing a continued policy of tax cuts for the wealthy. So they're attempting to change the subject, but use the same tactic. And it would be, of course, terrible if that happens. And one has to worry that a president and a Democratic Party that has not responded in the way that you need to respond to a totally implacable and unreasonable opponent, will give into that kind of thing over the next over the next time period.
I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the significance of the timing as well. We are faced with a world that is facing an economic downturn since 2007. We are seeing more and more a distancing from many countries away from the U.S. President Evo Morales has cut ties and has ended the USA program, USAID, AID program in Bolivia, denouncing this as a program that undermines sovereignty and subverts the sovereign rights of that country to govern itself. So in many ways, I see the shutdown of the government not as a threat to the corporations or to the same players that benefit any time there's an economic downturn, you know, the kind of consolidation that takes place where big banks become bigger and the smaller ones get gobbled up. But rather, I'm curious as to the kind of language that this used to bringing the masses into buying that there's a need for austerity, that there's a need for cuts, but we never get to participate as to saying, what should we cut? Should we cut the military spending budget? Should we cut, you know, the heavy salaries that we pay to consultants for government? Where should we cut? And so can we talk a little bit about the consequences that austerity will have on the kinds of battles that have been, you know, fought and won to have this kind of entitlement programs that you're describing, Social Security, Medicare, etc.
Given your interest and your listenership's interest in Latin America, you notice something that the U.S. press has been entirely silent about concerning the latest United Nations session, that the most notable, you know, thing that took place this year in the United Nations was the unanimous voices of presidents from South America speaking out, you know, rejecting the U.S. spying, rejecting the U.S. drug program, anti-drug program, and essentially saying in a more forthright and united way that, you know, that they are simply not going to be putting up with this anymore. And that's a wonderful trend to see the progressive leaders in the South American continent basically speaking with one voice. Now, on the issue of austerity, this is simply the continuation of what has been the response in both Europe, Canada, U.S., North America, and Europe have responded to the crisis that was long brewing. It was a crisis that the groundwork for this crisis was built with the escalating inequality in wealth and income that was, you know, an inevitable outgrowth of the neoliberal economic policies that became ascendant beginning in the 1980s. So for 30 or 40 years, we had escalating inequality in the advanced economies at the same time that we had deregulation of the financial sector and globalization of finance. Well, when you combine those two things, at some point or another, that was going to generate a crisis, and that's what happened with the financial crisis in 2008, which triggered a recession. The governments, whether center-right or center-left, in Europe or the United States, have failed to fix either of those problems. They have failed to rein in finance. We now have a financial sector that is just as dangerous as it was before the financial collapse, before the passage of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Act here in the United States. That was a failure to regulate finance. And we also have a failure to do what economists since the time of Keynes and the Great Depression have known as necessary when you have a recession and a slump, where consumption and investment is not going to be sufficient, you know, to put people back to work. The government has to come in with fiscal stimulus. And the whole austerity response has been essentially a refusal to do anything about the stagnation. Where the sequestration and the sort of government shutdown comes into play is for the past 6 years now, we are constantly being told that the recession is over, that the economy is picking up, and every little sign of a green shoot that anybody sees that things are getting better, we're told that, you know, now we're coming out of this thanks to the wisdom of the economic policies that they've been enacting. Well, for the most part, that has been untrue. For the most part, the recovery has been a recovery for the wealthy, a recovery for the stock market, but no, it hasn't been a recovery for jobs, and it hasn't been a recovery for wages. And that's no accident, and of course that has to do with who's running the show. But to the extent that the U.S. economy was at least beginning to improve slightly, what this does is it essentially throws a huge slap of cold water in the face of what was really not even a recovery. There's every reason to believe that we're going to be in this fight over the debt ceiling, that all they will do is sort of kick the can down the road a month and a half. And what that does is it perpetuates a political environment in which you're going to have fiscal policy essentially prioritizing cuts rather than stimulus, and it is very likely to push us back into a very, very severe, an even more severe recession, and it guarantees that there will be no significant recovery. And this is all happening at the same time that Europe also is still mired in its austerity policies that do nothing more than guarantee continued unemployment and impossible conditions in the south of Europe.
You know, it's interesting when I'm listening to you about the kinds of programs that are under threat, really under threat, if austerity wins the day as it has for the past, 30 years and, throughout the world. The kinds of programs, Social Security, Medicare, but more importantly, I think, it's a war against the workers, because if you think about who are the ones being displaced right now, who are the ones without job security? If we really think about the government shutdown, seems to be, to me, just another political act to, apply a little more pressure to the public into buying this narrative that austerity is the only way. It has been done very effectively throughout the world, where countries are forced into IMF loans only when accepting, the kinds of projects that they want, of privatization, of government, deregulation. So all of this seems to be an old game card that's been used over and over, and it's just taking a different, it's just being replayed in a different way in the States, pretending that the government has somehow come to an impasse. But in many ways, what prevents Obama from taking a presidential decree the way, George Bush did, and acting to protect the American people?
One of the things that is not mentioned in the media is that Obama has at his disposal a mechanism that he could use to essentially trump the blackmail card of refusing to raise the U.S. federal debt ceiling, which is what the Republican House of Representatives is attempting to blackmail both Obama and the U.S. public with. All he has to do is tell the Federal Reserve to not loan the Treasury, but go ahead and give a grant of money to the Treasury until we pass a budget so that, once again, spending can incur. He is unprepared to use the same kind of legal gimmickry that the other side is more than willing to use in their battle, and Obama is refusing to do that and basically saying, my hands are tied. Well, that's not even true. It is an important sort of historical perspective that people need to be aware of. And you've just pointed it out, that if you go back to the 80s and the 90s, it was the IMF programs that were imposed on emerging market economies and third world economies that were the first version of this neoliberal austerity as the answer to all economic problems. You deregulate international finance, it creates financial crises in lesser developed economies, and then those crises, the response that's being preached and being carried out there for two decades by the IMF in the third world is counterproductive austerity that does nothing more than punish the victims without solving the problem. And what's new in the world scene since 2008 is that same medicine is now being meted out to the advanced economies. And if you're taking a look at it from, well, who is this a war against? It's essentially a war against not only the poor and the programs that, the meager programs that were won, the welfare state meager programs that were won for the poor, in the advanced economies in the middle of the 20th century, it's not only them, it's the middle classes in those countries that are now under full frontal attack. The middle classes in North America and in Europe now face prospects that are even worse than the economic prospects, you know, that their parents had. The young generation in North America and Europe is the first generation who face, as a whole, worse economic prospects than their parents. And that's what's at stake, and that's what's going on.
The more I look at it, is that this is not just about the Obamacare. It would be naive to believe that if he had conceded to this, that this would end and things would be restored and funding would be restored. This is about the Keystone Pipeline. This is about muscling, you know, whatever small levels of regulation we still have in place. And literally removing our democratic right to participate in the way governments are to conduct the business of the nation. So how long can this carry on? How long can they shut down the government and, you know, in order to push this? Is there a point where either one would have to step in and take a stand? And how do you see this unfolding?
At this point, the shift in public opinion is clearly against the Republicans and in favor of the Democrats, because the public at large is seeing the Republicans as the unreasonable, obstinate player. And the public at large is seeing Obama and the Democrats as being more reasonable. And so there's a shift in public opinion that's against the Republicans. And as I said before, this is also creating sort of a crisis within the Republican Party between the Tea Party people who have wanted to, they want to draw the line in the sand over Obamacare. And now people like Paul Ryan and the sort of Republican leadership realizes that that battle is lost, and they want to use the same tactic to draw the line over the debt ceiling and a grand fiscal compromise, which of course won't be a compromise at all. What they will simply do is continue to negotiate by saying, you give us this and we give you nothing. I mean, that's what's staring us in the future. It's increasingly apparent that the U.S. political system is actually now in a condition where we have gridlock and stalemate, and we are incapable of addressing anything in any sort of reasonable way. That's becoming increasingly apparent. Sometimes this is because we have a constitution that is the oldest and most out-of-date constitution on the planet at this point. The whole idea that the Supreme Court can make rulings about unlimited contributions to political campaigns, that kind of thing doesn't go on in other countries. On the other hand, and I wanted to mention this, apparently there's one area where the U.S. Constitution, or the fact that we have one, creates a more favorable environment than you have in Canada. We down here have been amazed at the ability of the Harper government to literally muzzle civil society and scientists and prevent them from saying what in fact will be, you know, the scientifically predicted effects of the tar sands oil extraction. The Harper government is hell-bent on turning Canada into a natural resource extraction, fossil fuel extraction, exporting economy, despite all of the scientific evidence about the damage this will cause. And at least one of the things that the Constitution continues to protect here in the United States is, at least if you create, you know, an NGO where you are a scientist, you can't be muzzled. You can't be literally forced not to say what you know to be the truth. That aside, we are fast descending into a condition of ungovernability, even in just sort of the regular old day affairs, such as making it possible for the government to pay its bills and, you know, avoiding, you know, financial chaos in international markets when the U.S. Treasury says, I'm sorry, your bond is due, but we actually can't pay off on it. So that's the condition we find ourselves in, and sort of it's very difficult to predict where that ends up.
In essence, to me, this shutdown of the U.S. Senate, it's nothing more than yet another chess card. You know, if you're a chess player, you have your little moves, and this is perhaps one of their last moves. But to me, it's not so much who gets to be reelected. Is this a nice way for Obama to get the Democrats party reelected when they have really shown no commitment at all to the American people in terms of really creating policies that can generate jobs, that can generate redistribution for the poor? So is it time for another party? Is it time to start thinking outside political parties?
Our political situation in the United States is less favorable because of our electoral system, our electoral laws. The lines for the congressional districts are drawn by state legislators, and there are Republican state legislatures in a number of states that have drawn the lines so that there are safe districts for Tea Party Republicans. The irony here is that at the same time that public opinion in the United States is in general moving strongly against the Republicans that are doing this, that inside their own congressional districts, any Tea Party Republican that does not behave in this way runs the risk that they will be challenged in less than 2 years, because they have to run for re-election every 2 years, by another Tea Party Republican that said, oh, you gave in, and I won't. There's some very perverse incentives for the people who are digging their heels in and refusing to let the country be governed to continue to do so, because they would be punished for stopping this within their own congressional districts, even though general public opinion countrywide, you know, is moving strongly against them. So there's a number of ways in which we have political conditions here. The financial system for elections, the winner-take-all, the state legislatures that are drawing these gerrymandered districts, all of this is part of the dilemma that we face when we try and mount some sort of political strategy for overcoming the situation we're in. On the other hand, there is nothing preventing us from building mass movements and stronger movements and mobilizing public opinion and essentially moving on that part of what is, you know, has got to be the central part of any successful strategy to turn things around. And hopefully that's what we will be doing. We haven't even mentioned the fact that the big problem worldwide, besides our inability to pull the advanced economies out of this unnecessary and destructive sort of economic policies, is the evidence that we are headed for disastrous climate change is ever greater. And it really does come down worldwide to a very simple question. Are we going to be extracting the dirtier oil, the dirtier coal? Are we going to extract every last drop of fossil fuel, you know, that's on the planet and burn it? Or are we going to actually stop ourselves from doing that? And that's where the Canadian Harper government is leading the charge. Their strategy for Canada is to simply extract, doesn't matter how much difficult and how much dirtier it is in terms of the domestic consequences, the global consequences of extracting all that and burning it, whether it's being, it'll be burned in China, it'll be burned in Japan, it won't be burned in Canada, but it isn't going to make any difference. That struggle to stop the fossil fuel industries and the governments who they have in their pockets from pursuing their own narrow-minded self-interest over the next 10 years to the detriment of the planet and all of us is I do believe that's the bell that is rung that we all have to respond to.
You know, it seems to me that it's time we as people, you know, forget governments and countries, but we as people recognize our collective responsibility for one another. In your book, The Political Economy of Participatory Economics, you talk about, you know, the need for this for the people, by the people, ethic of caring and imagining economics. So what are some of the solutions, what are some of the alternatives that we could have put in place if people were, you know, to come together?
The point of those books is to refute the lie that there is no alternative to capitalism or old authoritarian planning type of socialism. That is one of the fundamental myths that it's an enabling myth for the people who want to continue to run the world as a global capitalist economy to the point where we asphyxiate ourselves to death, we boil ourselves to death through global warming, And in the process, all we are doing is generating ever greater wealth for the, you know, for the 1%, while not only the poor, but the middle classes continue to suffer. And so the purpose of those books is to explain that that's not the case at all. That's a very convenient story for them to tell, and if they can continue to get everybody to believe that, then essentially they can convince people to tolerate what it is that we're putting up with. But the truth of the matter is that the original vision of socialists, that we do not have to commodify the entire planet. We don't have to turn nature into a commodity. We don't have to deal with each other, you know, in the economics of competition and greed. That the idea that we can engage in equitable cooperation, and we can do this by managing our economies ourselves, was never a pipe dream. It was never a myth. It's perfectly possible. And that's what those books are about. They're explaining how, in fact, this can be done. To cut Medicaid programs, if we have to cut back on all of these kinds of programs, the answer can't be that we have to do it because the economy is less productive, because, in fact, the economy is more productive. The answer has to be they have to be cut back because somebody else is taking a bigger chunk of what we all have amongst us. And that's precisely what's happened. And the somebody else that's taking a bigger chunk is the 1%, it's the financial industry, it's the natural resource extracting companies and their stockholders. That's who is taking much more than they ever were allowed to take in the past, and they're the ones telling us that we can't afford the things that we needed and enjoyed in the past.
That's beautifully said. Thank you so much for being with us. Just before you leave us, please tell our audience how they can access your books and what inspires you. What inspires you to keep fighting and know that, you know, you can and we can together transform this way of seeing our economy, our society, ourselves.
The best book for people to get that's the most recent and accessible, you know, presentation of there is an alternative, is Of the People, By the People, The Case for a Participatory Economy. And the title of that book intends to convey the message that if you want the economy to run for the people, then it's only going to do that if the economy is of the people and by the people. Only when we run our own economy is it going to be run in our interests. Thinking that it's going to be run in our interests because we leave it to the people that own the corporations to run it in our interests, or it's going to be run in our interest because some group of planners, some central authority of planners is going to run it in our interest. That's a pipe dream. That's what history has disproved. That's the best book for people to get a hold of. As far as what inspires me, there is no choice, Sylvia. We have no choice but to, you know, wage the struggle. And there is no reason for us to be pessimistic. There are many, many situations and many times in history where if you had tried to predict a favorable outcome, it would not have been, you know, what people would have bet on. You know, you wouldn't have bet on it in Las Vegas. So we have to remember that we have no choice. We have to continue the struggle. And we should not be pessimistic about the fact that when people do that, sometimes surprisingly good things happen.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Dr. Robin Hanel. He is the author of the People, By the People, A Case for Participatory Economy. Thank you again for being with us and for all that you do to transform this world into a more just and equitable world.
Have a great day up there in Canada.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We have come to the end of our show, Latin Waves. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program. Program is available free of charge to campus and community stations across Canada and the U.S. For more information about our work or to support our efforts, please visit our website at www.latinwavesmedia.com.